Welcome to the Art Grind Podcast. This is a podcast run by artists for artists where we talk about what it means to be one. I'm Tun Mian, the producer, with our host Dina Brodsky and Marshall Jones. This is being recorded between our many jobs and side hustles. We bring you in-depth investigations into the lives of artists we admire and the stories behind the creative journey. So stay on the grind while we fill your mind.
Hi, everyone. This is Dina Brodsky, and I'm here with Candace Hunter, and Marshall Jones will actually not be joining us until the second part of this interview. So just for a little bit of context, we recorded an absolutely brilliant, fascinating interview with Candace about 5 months ago, the first part of which completely vanished due to technical difficulties on my end. So we're bringing Candace back to try to remember some of the brilliant things that she said during this interview, part one. And on one hand, sorry, everyone. And on the other hand, Candace, I feel like you have all these big things to announce, and that's going to be happening during this part of the interview as well. So thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for re-inviting me. I'm happy to be here with you.
You know, it might have all just been a secret ploy to get you to come back, because I enjoyed your company so much. Candace, let's start with, and also, as you know, a bit of context, I met Candace during a residency last September at Cuddy Hunk, and I was almost immediately like stricken by how incredibly charismatic, like, you're one of the most charismatic people I've ever met, along with being a good artist and a thinker. So I feel like every chance I got, I was like, Candace, just talk about your life a little bit. So I would love it if it would be possible for you to do this on the podcast. But let's maybe start with the earlier part of your life. Like what was your childhood like?
What was my childhood like? Oh, we're going really far back. As people are reminding me these days that I'm in the elder category now, it's hard for me to accept that, but I guess I am. So lo, those many years ago, down home on the prairie. Okay, I'm being very silly. Forgive me, Dina. I am a Chicago-born gal. I am a South Side of Chicago gal. I am a Catholic school-raised gal. I am a Latin scholar, Pan-Africanist, child of a parent, child of a mathematician, grandchild of the first Black man in the Indiana House of Representatives. And he was also the senior House leader for the last 16 years of his life. I always like to point this out, that my grandfather penned the desegregation law for the school systems in Indiana. And he did that 2 years before Brown versus the Board of Education. So he was an incredible human being who saw a need that he could fulfill in creating a more just world. So I grew up in a household where that was important for people. So that's what I knew as a child. And just as we started, you know, as we start the Zoom, my lovely family's going to walk in the door. So I'm just going to wave at them and we'll keep on. So that was my life. I'm the youngest of four children. And for anyone in the listening audience who's grown up with multiple siblings, the last child is the child that gets left alone the most. So some people go, oh, you're the baby, you're spoiled. What it is that the parent goes, oh, you're not going to break. You hit your head, you're not going to die. You got a cough, it's okay. Go cough. Go in the other room, though, and cough. So you're left alone. Your siblings don't want to play with you, you know. And I think if it's multiple siblings, it's that baby who becomes the artist, because they're left alone to think.
You know, I actually read somewhere that the last child of the family is most likely to follow their dreams. And also that the youngest child of the family is most likely to end up non-heterosexual, which actually might have something to do with being more likely to follow their dreams too. So basically any sort of non-straightforward path, it seems like the older children have a lot of pressure to do things kind of the right way. And yeah, you might have been let alone to think and to dream and to kind of follow where your heart led you. So yeah, do you remember if you were one of these kids that drew all the time then?
Oh, absolutely. I always tell the story that the first time, my mother had her whole house professionally painted. They had moved the piano back away from the wall. And the painter asked her, well, do you want me to paint over these drawings down here? So the piano was at a kitty corner. And so it gave me enough space to get behind it. And it was my private little world. And so I drew on those wonderful walls that were empty. No one else had to see them but me. And so the house painter discovered my paintings. And of course, my mother had not seen them and was not pleased, and she had them covered up. I wish it had been in today's modern world where at least some pictures could have been taken of it, a cell phone brought out and click, click. But no, because I have no idea what they looked like. I just knew that that's where I drew all by myself, kind of in the semi-darkness.
And do you remember, you know, what were your siblings doing? Were they artistic also
No. No. So the oldest... my brother he was always exploring and always dragging his younger brother into trouble because he was always doing things he had no business doing. And so the second son followed him behind, and he would say, oh, I saw him get in trouble, so I didn't have to. And then the next in line was my sister, who very charismatic, and I think that was just our mother, the kind of person our mother was, that all of us were outgoing like that. But she moved into medicine, and that world has always been her life. And so we're all really, really different people, and I'm the only artist.
It sounds like you're from an incredibly accomplished family, and, you know, not just from this interview, but from when we talked, like you talk about your siblings, and I was like, okay, these would be people who'd be really scary to like live up to. Did your parents think that you'd become a doctor, or, you know, what was their plan? And I mean,
my mother just begged me to teach. Just like, if you teach, it's okay. Just get your teaching degree, teach, you know, you can take care of yourself if you're teaching.
You know what's funny is my mother stopped saying that. Like, you know, she really wanted me to be a college professor, which was something that in retrospect I would have had really no aptitude for. I think she kind of had this dream of either being able to say that her daughter is a professor, or like something that other than like just an artist, which sounds really flighty. But up until about a year ago, she was like, are you applying for teaching jobs? And at some point a year ago, I was like, but mom, I would be terrible at this. And also I got rejected from all of them. I mean, there's probably nowhere left for me to apply to. And I think she kind of finally my parents are amazing, but I think it took that long for her to make peace for like my lack of professorial abilities. So what did you, I mean, you were a kid, you're there drawing behind the piano. Did you feel like there could be a life in that? Or was it like, oh, I'll do this for a bit and then do something more practical?
So I think all of my life, I've been, for lack of a better term, a creative and kind of producing my own life. So I did theater. As a child, I remember writing a play, directing the play, casting it, making costumes for it, creating the little tickets, selling them in the neighborhood, popping popcorn that I sold in little brown bags, and then dispersing the money we made with my cast. And I remember telling a fella one time in early in my dating life that I had done this. And he said, "What? How old were you?" I said, "Second grade." He says, "Well, that's not possible." And I said, "What's not possible?" He said, "You couldn't have done all that in the second grade." And I said, "Of course I did." And he says, no second grader can do all that. And that's when I realized that this gentleman was not someone I needed to continue to be with. Because if you deny that a child can't create their own universe, then, you know, you don't really see the world. Because children are the ones who really can create their own worlds before the world gets in the way of their dreams. So, whatever I wanted to do as a child, I pretty much did. As a young adult, whatever I wanted to do, I pretty much did. So I was in theater on a lark, and I ended up getting in a play that ran for nearly 4 years. And traveled around the East Coast and the Midwest with the play. And it's so funny, about a year ago, last summer, it went across the internet like wildfire. There was a long lost interview with James Baldwin. Esquire put it online, and they talked about this interview that had been done for CBS, and it never aired. And so they were releasing it for the first time. Well, when I was doing the play I told you that I did for 4 years was James Baldwin's The Amen Corner. And we had done it at the Lincoln Center in New York and the Mitzi Newhouse Theater at the Lincoln Center. And I remember that there was a TV crew that came to interview him there in the theater, and they recorded some of our rehearsal. And it was for a TV program that was supposed to air like on a Sunday evening. And of course, we performed on Sunday evenings. So all of us, I think, assumed that it had aired and we just couldn't see it because we were working. So here it is, decades later, and it's finally released. And people started calling me going, "Oh my God, do you remember when? Da 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 da." And so I got it, I looked at it. And there was a very young me in the first 2 minutes, and I was just cracking up. I'm just like, oh my, because, you know, to see yourself again at 20 something, when you're, okay, we don't need to discuss the decades, but when you're a little older than that, it was pretty amazing. And to be in this wonderful, piece that's about James Baldwin was just, it was one of those things that made me go, I've always been on the right path. Always, always, always.
You know, you also, even like, you know, so me and Candace talked a little bit before the interview started, and she was talking about, you know, well, you're talking about your current project, which sounds amazing, but it also sounds huge and like, barely manageable. And, you know, I was like a little bit in awe of it, but it also sounds a lot like this is what that second grader you that directed the play and, you know, like popped the popcorn. That's the path you were on. You were the second grader that didn't think it was impossible. And now you're the adult who, you know, yes, you have different resources and, you know, people listen to you. So you can probably assemble like a better team than a bunch of other second graders, but you're still kind of doing that thing that's like just out of reach and maybe seems impossible for most people, but it's possible for you because that's who you are.
And thank you for putting it like that. Sometimes I need other people to point out to me what I'm possible of doing. So thank you, Dina, for that.
But like, you're always the same. I don't know if you have ever had like moments of self-doubt in your life, but
of course.
But I imagine you just taking on these projects and not doubting for a second that you're capable of doing it.
What has happened is that I'll see something, and it's usually a large something, and I just want to do it. And I've never allowed anything to get in the way of my doing it. And so I don't know where that came from, or what it's. So one time I was not harping on these people I have dated before, but one time I was dating a gentleman who was a chair of English department at one of the universities here in Illinois. And it was when that new film had come out on quantum physics. And so he had brought a copy of it over to the house for us to watch, have some wine and watch a film on quantum physics. And I'm just like, if this is not the most boring thing date ever, why am I, you know? So he's watching it and then he wants to watch it a second time. And I'm just like, okay, why? And
he's trying to impress you with his intellectual prowess.
Yes. And so that's what I was feeling. I said, I'm not that person. I don't even really know what physics is. And I was just like, la, la, la. And he says, oh, but Candace, you are a quantum physicist. And I said, excuse me, what? And he says, Candace, you continually and constantly make possible the impossible. And I said, what? And he says, think about your art, Candace. Every time you see something that wasn't there and you make it physically possible, you have become a quantum physicist. And I went, oh my. So then I watched the film again with him. And I said, okay, maybe I am. Maybe that is what I do.
Do you know what? It is what you do. I'm not sure I run with this whole quantum physics analogy, but if he was trying to be romantic in this way. But like what he's saying is, you know, you're a magician. Like you talk worlds into being.
Yes, I'm a magician.
I actually wanted to talk a little bit about what you're doing right now, because that's something there's going to be this whole, you know, this will be spliced together with the second part of this interview, at which point I think you weren't working on that project yet. And I feel like the project sounds fascinating. And yeah, if you don't mind, if it's not top secret, could you talk about it a little bit?
No. So I'm very excited to be working on my next large scale show. It will be an immersive installation. And the title is The Alien Nations and Sovereign States of Octavia E. Butler. So for anyone who's listening who doesn't know who Octavia Butler is, I need you to run out right now and get one of her books, or get her on Audible or get her on Kindle. Octavia Butler was a speculative fiction or science fiction writer, African-American, who, when she was a girl, fell in love with science fiction writing, but did not see herself on the pages of anything she read. So at 14, she said, I got to write myself in. And so she did. And so she started writing at 14. By 17, her first short story was published. She went under the wing of Samuel Delaney, who was a Black science fiction writer, probably the king of that at the time, who said, you're brilliant and the world needs to know you. So he took her under his wing, and she was a Nebula Award winner. She's won every award for science fiction writing. She's a MacArthur Genius Grant person. And just a brilliant, brilliant woman who wrote about the future and the past and the cyclical nature of that. She wrote worlds that were very similar to what we're in right now. She wrote about worlds that were very alien in nature. So I'm looking at her world that looks like what we're in right now, and the world where they're really aliens, and what those two worlds are saying in common. So it's a conversation about otherness and who is other and why is there other and am I other? Are you other? Who is the other? And what and where, when you're standing somewhere, how can you be other? So it's a conversation between these two worlds that she's created that are on the surface seem very, very separate, but she still asked the same questions in both of them. So there'll also be a reader's nook in this place, a place for young readers and older readers to sit down and pull out science fiction writing, either by Octavia or some of the newer writers, and sit down and be comfortable in this space that'll look very green and lush and sit and enjoy books, but also be able to walk through all of the space. There'll be a film as part of it and a soundscape and just a lot of lushness and wonderfulness. And I hope that I honor Octavia Butler well with this.
I think she's going to be thrilled.
Well, she's gone, so I'm hoping she's looking down from wherever she is and is pleased.
So she'll be thrilled looking down from wherever she is. And I actually, you know, this is terrible. I love her. I love her. I feel like I read her ages ago when it was just like her work evolved and got much more complex as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you know, I loved the really simple stuff from like, you know, way back when too. And I actually had no idea she was gone. Like I think I just assumed that she was a contemporary, you know, like she gets mentioned as a contemporary writer and I assume that she, okay. So you can't like write her and be, you know, at least physically and be like, hey, by the way, come to this, hang out in the reader's nook. wherever she is, she's going to be thrilled.
I hope so. I hope so. I hope I honor her name. And this.
But can you talk a little bit about what the scope of this is? Because it's going to be huge.
So I hope that. So 2 weeks ago, I got in the car and I drove down to Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, because I heard that Toshi Reagan was presenting her opera, Parable of the Sower, down there for one night. And so it's where my daughter was in school. And I said, oh, I can grab her too. Well, she's busy, so she couldn't. But drove the 2.5 hours down there to witness the opera about Parable of the Sower, because Parable of the Sower is one of the books that's on one side of the gallery, and the Xenogenesis trilogy or Lilith's Brood is on the other side. And then in the center, there's a collision of worlds, something, because we know energy, it takes energy to tear something down, to destroy it. It takes energy to build something new. So this collision wall in the middle is a mashup of these two very different worlds. So I'm hoping that academics, young scholars, teens, even some little kids can come in and witness this procession of people leaving their homes, because it speaks to an immigrant population and those who've had to flee because of external forces. So it looks very, very modern of families that have to go, but where are you going to? And then the aliens on the other side that speak to the whole foolish notion of eugenics, because it has popped up in our, as far as history goes, in our recent history. So it popped up in Nazi Germany, it popped up in Australia. I'm sure it's going to pop up again, where people think you can breed something out of someone that you don't like. And you can't. Genes don't work that way, but foolish men somehow keep thinking that, oh yeah, I can get rid of everything we don't like. but that's not going to happen. So the thing is, how do you accept the other? How do you live with the other? How is being in the same place with the other making the world better? And so that's what I'm hoping to present in the work. And I'm hoping people see that. I don't know. You never know what an audience is going to take away. All you can do is present what you hope they will. And they may walk away with things that I never anticipated that will make me sit back in awe of the minds of other people.
But it also sounds like they'll walk away with an experience. Like they'll walk away having lived through a little bit of a different universe that you built.
Yeah. So it's very exciting that I'm building two worlds. It's just like, if you could see the studio in here, Dina, right now, it's like, it's crazy. And this is just a tiny fraction of what it's going to be. But man, I'm excited.
I bet that second grader you is so proud of you right now. Being like is this exactly what she wanted, that version of you, right? Like,
yeah,
like you just now have, you know, more years and more power, right?
Yeah.
Build the kind of world that you want. You know, it's funny. I wonder, you know, we build ourselves like kind of as we move through life, but I sometimes wonder how much we actually change. And still have my first sketchbooks, diaries, whatever it was from like when we just came to this country. And I'm better at drawing, you know, my handwriting's a little better. But ultimately, I think I just wanted to document the world. My ability to do so has, you know, has maybe improved. But I'm not sure I've changed that much. Like I just sort of, you know, my hand got a little bit better at doing some stuff.
I agree with you. I think who we were is who we are with a better skill set.
If we get lucky, right? Like if we get lucky.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If we're allowed to be who we are.
Or
beaten down.
Yes.
A lot of people are beaten down from who they were.
Like if life doesn't wreck us, but you know, I go to my kids, you know, like elementary school pickup, and every one of those kids have like, you know, they all have a spark in their eye. And you know, and my high school, like I feel like half of them are kind of moving through like zombies, you know, probably from like, I don't know, lack of sleep or too much screen time or whatever it is. And I'm like, all right, like why does some people keep it and some people don't? Like why does life, you know, I mean, there's things like poverty and there's things like kind of, you know, and sickness that will beat down the best of us. But, you know, there's plenty of people who aren't dealing with those factors and life still rings you out and turns you into a corporate accountant. No, I didn't, you know, there's probably plenty of really creative.
Right, don't say that, right.
A lot of really creative and happy corporate accountants. I did not mean that. Do you ever like marvel at the fact that life is letting you like, I mean, this is my thing. Like I'm always waiting for the other shoe to drop. Can't believe life just let me hang out and make paintings all day long. And maybe record a podcast with a really interesting person. Like I'm always waiting for like the other shoe to be like, nope, you've got to go deal with X, Y, and Z. And all of these things are going to be really hard. And each day of just normal life feels like a gift.
And it is. So 20 years ago, I wouldn't have imagined that I have the partner that I have in my life, that I have the child who's a grown woman in my life, and that every day who they are in my life makes my life better. And, you know, it's a blessing. It's an absolute blessing. And even though it's so funny, we were talking one day in-house, we were talking about child rearing. And so, you know, the dad, because they're in the room with me, I can say these things. He's the more generous parent. And I had said to her one day, wait a minute, was I the mean parent? And she goes, yeah, but I liked it. And I'm just like, but and I was like, okay, I was the mean parent, or the stern one, or whatever those words are. But she took it and she grew with it. And I think all three of us are better off being in each other's lives. I think we're blessed. But I recognize that not everyone has this same kind of thing in their life. And so, you know, I'm very thankful. Absolutely thankful.
It's funny. I grew up with consistent love. And because I grew up like that, I completely took it for granted. Like I just thought that this is something everyone has. Right. And it took, you know, many years and kind of getting slapped in the face by life as an adult a little bit to be like, nope, a lot of people don't grow up like this. And that, yeah. And it makes their life so exponentially harder. And I feel like a lot of the other things, like, you know, we were like refugees when we came here. It was an immigrant family. It wasn't like there was a huge amount of like money or resources to go around, but there was always love and there was always consistency and there was always safety. And I only now realize how much I took it for granted. Maybe I took it for granted because it was consistent love and safety. Right.
Absolutely.
Maybe you don't take it for granted when you know what life can be like without that.
Yeah.
So, it sounds like this is sort of what your family is like. Like, there's also like ambition and creativity and like all the stuff that you grew up with. Like, you're from like a high achieving clan. I'm assuming your daughter is also like, she sounds like another high achieving person. But overall, like, it seems like that's what, you know, you were held in love that way.
Yeah. I'm pleased. I'm thankful for the family I come from. And you know, like you were saying, you take certain things for granted. As a child, I thought that everyone traveled. I thought that everybody went to museums every chance that they could. I thought that every little girl had their favorite place at the Art Institute of Chicago to go and sit. That's what I thought, because I did. And so that's, you know, when you have those wonderful things, you think that everyone else has it as well. And when you start realizing that, no, a lot of people don't have this, you really have to start adjusting how you see the world and how you interact with kindness to other people in the world who did not have the same grace that was given to you.
And who might not be necessarily kind to you, actually, because I think a lot of the people that grow up without, you know, like not without the financial resources, but without the emotional resources, don't wind up being kind. And, you know, kind of, you know, like when I move through the world and sometimes I see someone acting like a huge jerk. And my first reaction is like, God, you're a huge jerk. There's really no necessity to do this. And then you kind of, I try to detach myself from that reaction. Be like, I think they didn't have this kind of home to go back to, or the safety net, or, you know, like, or the love or the warmth, like all the things that I thought that everybody had. But if you grow up without it, you're just a much more prickly person. And become, you know, an unprickly person who is amazing and, you know, conscious and creates these things for others. So, but yeah, that's kind of been my, you know, like I've been trying to explain this to my kids, like, you know, like, I'm like, it doesn't matter who has what, it doesn't matter who brags about what, like there's really like two things that matter, right? But it feels like you kind of spread a lot, you know, you spread a lot of these things into the world, like outside of just your family.
I don't even think that I try. I think I just, it's innate.
Well, that's a little bit magical. So it may, you know, for you, it might be innate.
No. My sister used to always say to me, when I would encounter someone who was not being someone that I thought they should have been, she'd go, "Candace, you have to remember that your mother didn't raise them." And I had to go, oh, right. They didn't have me. Okay. I get it now, because she was special. She didn't just take her children for cultural and artistic opportunities. She would allow her four children, each one of us, to take a friend with us. To anything she took us to. So she was educating the entire neighborhood as well as the children that she taught. Like, no, we're all going to see the world together. We're all going to see the magic together. We're all going to make magic together. And so I come from a magical mom. So it makes sense that I'm magic.
I think the first page of The Great Gatsby goes something along those lines, where like the guy's quoting his father and he says, you know, just remember that not everyone had the same, you know, same opportunities you did. You give it back though. Like I feel like you put the magic back out into the world. So whatever your mom gave you, I feel like, you know, like you're the person that gives it back tenfold to the, and that's,
I hope so.
Well, that's what I got from being around you for a week.
Thank you, darling.
All right, we're back on Marshall's computer this time around.
So we left off, and you were talking about how you don't wait for the muse, how it's all about putting in the work. And you said something kind of interesting that was, you don't question how good it is. That's not for you to determine. You just do the work. But that seems like a very hard thing to do, you know?
Oh, but you have to. History is going to decide who we are. That's, you know, we're not the arbiters of that. Wow. All we can do is the best that we can do. And
so, I'd love to get an idea of what your show looked like, the one that was in Chicago, the Water Rights show. What, when you walk in, what are you seeing in that show?
So there are torsos that are headless and legless, and they were cut from Scottish birch. Is that right? I've forgotten now, because I had a wonderful woodworker who actually cut all of these torsos for me, and I'd be remiss if I didn't say Kendall Glover. Because he was just the best. In fact, when I, you know, first talked to him about what I wanted to do, I said, so, you know, let's go to Home Depot and price out the plywood and, you know, cut these figures. And he said, no, we're not going to Home Depot. Sorry, Home Depot. He said, no, we're going to a lumber yard. And I had never really been in a lumber yard. You know, it was fascinating. And he knew everything about wood. And all of a sudden he turned into this incredible professor. And he was explaining wood and trees and how they grow and where they grow and why this wood is denser and why this wood is waxy and oily and why this, you know, wood is cheaper and where it is and why this wood isn't, you can't find it anymore. And that's why the price is. And it was just amazing to me. And I was just like, wow. So the first prototypes for the show, we actually cut from woods that were in water drought areas. And they're the most dense woods because they're taking the longest to grow because of the lack of water. And so we used wenge wood, which you practically cannot get anymore. And wenge and zebra wood. So we made the first prototypes from those two woods. We could not use boxwood, he says, because you can't, he says, Candace, you can't pay me enough for the saws that I would destroy trying to cut that wood because it's so dense and so hard. So we first did these small pieces that were, I think they were 18 inches tall. Then the ones that we actually created for the show were of plywood, but very good woods that I painted on, I collaged on, I assembled things on. So each one was very, very different from its neighbor to the left or right of it. And so there's a line of these torsos that walk towards a well, and I would create a well in the interior of the space, and then these torsos that walk away from the well. Above their heads for the very first show, there was shelving built, and there would be different water vessels above their head, depending on what culture I was looking at or what country I was looking at. So the women spoke to women in Central America and Southeast Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa. And so there was fabric, there were rice pots, there were clay pots on, you know, so there was a water vessel with each woman. When I built the first well, I literally brought in 800 pounds of dirt by myself.
Whoa.
So when I say art is work, I mean labor. I mean serious labor. Yeah, the people loaded in my car, and my car kind of like dunked down in the back the whole time I was driving, like, oh, will I even make it? And I literally took out bag after bag and built this faux well in the corner of the gallery, and I had moss all on it, and friends of mine, I have a friend from Mali who gave me a vintage winch system. So, you know, I had created what looked like this barely modern system, trestle kind of system above the opening of what the well would be. And he came over and he says, I've got a winch for you. And I'm just like, well, what little Renaissance woman, beard chugging woman are you talking? He says, no, Candace. And I said, okay. Yeah, so, you know, both are, you know, obsolete words. No one says them anymore. So that was added to it. And as I was finishing it, I saw, and I talked about this just the other day. I said, I saw a tree branch and dragged it in. And Kendall said, oh, that's the meeting place. I said, what do you mean the meeting place? And he's, because I just looked at it visually and it worked for me. And he says, no, if you work that hard to get to the well, you're going to sit down. And you're going to sit down with other women. Mm. And you're going to talk about what is going on in your lives and on the road. And so there has to be a meeting place at the well, a place to rest, to chat before you move on. And I said, oh, that's perfect. Now, this is the funny thing. So I showed the slide of my branch. And a curator here in Chicago said, Candace, that's a damn log. I said, what? He says, that's a whole log. You didn't bring in a branch. That's a log. And so not only did I carry in 800 pounds of dirt, I carried in a log that I picked up and hoisted into my car with the windows down so that it literally hung out on both sides of the car. And I was just like, please don't let a policeman stop me because I don't know that I could explain this.
You know, Candace, I think lugging like 800 pounds of dirt is the exact opposite of waiting for the muse to come.
Absolutely.
It's like I could not think of like anything less like waiting for the muse.
So yeah, art is labor, art is work. And So this is what, while we were on Cutty Hunk, Dina, what I kept giggling at myself. So I am of the age that I think, and I could be wrong by 1 year, maybe. The year that I was graduating was the year that the whatever of colleges were putting together what are the requirements for an MFA. There was no MFA the year before I graduated. A BFA was the terminal degree in art. So the MFA was still a new thing, and you know, who had it? No one yet, right? So there are words that have been learned in MFA programs, and everyone on Cutty Hunk and all of the young artists that I meet and all of the grant applications, they always say, you know, what is your studio practice? So everyone says studio practice. No, I get it. It was not a phrase, a term that was used when I was in school. And so every time someone says it, I giggle a little bit. Because it's just like, oh, you're just practicing. Okay.
Oh, God. I'm guilty. I feel like I use that all the time. Or like,
you're just practicing. I'm working. And I tell people I'm working. What does my studio work look like? And I say that, and I, you know, and I giggle a little bit because, yeah, I work really hard, and I'm worrying about the day when I physically cannot do the same amount of work because it's coming. You know, I feel it. I really do. But so, yeah, I giggle at younger artists who, you know, we're always talking about their practice. And I'm just like, what, you got a violin? I don't know. I don't get the term. It makes no sense to me.
You know, Candace, I wonder, like, I mean, so I use that term kind of because everyone of my generation uses that term. But what you said actually makes me think about it. I wonder if, like, the fact that we say it that way in a way makes us take it less seriously. Like, oh, it's mm-hmm. just practice. Like I'm showing mm-hmm. up, I'm practicing this thing. And mm-hmm. and I wonder if it does something to our brain that, you know, like we're not entirely cognizant of just to use that term rather than using the term work.
So everything that I do is towards a finished end. It really is. I'm not investigating. I'm sorry, being mean now. But I'm not spending that time. Do you know the most time that I've ever spent not working was on our island? And I watched all of my lovely friends on the island just working their little hearts out. All of you were just making work. And I'm just like, yeah, I'm going to look at the ocean. I'm going to put my feet up. I'm not doing anything. And I still did some work, but I was just like, that's not why I'm here. I'm here to smell this air and meet people, because a lot of what we do, I think, is informed by relationships and gathering other understandings that are not a part of your central being. So the more I got to talk to Dominic, and I didn't talk to him nearly enough, the more I laughed with Will, the more I listened to your stories on the porch. And by the way, I got the mace in your pocket long before anybody else did, because I kept seeing you, you know, that thing you were doing on your side. I said, what's Dina doing? So I got your punchline long before you got there. And I didn't understand why the others didn't get it. I was just like, oh, you're just going to wait till she says it.
Okay. It was like Chekhov's gun, because you were in theater. You know what the Chekhov's gun is like. If there's a rifle on the wall, it's going to fire.
Right.
So just for, you know, for context, me and Candace met on this wonderful island in the middle of like I think it's as close to the middle of nowhere as I've ever been. Like, yes. Like we were on this art residency at Cuddyhunk. I don't know, it felt very like, so every residency I've ever done, which hasn't been that many because I can't handle application. I can't handle filling out an application and sending it in on time. It was very kind of, you know, figurative art, like, you know, you wake up in the morning and you paint all day. And this is the first time that we were actually encouraged to, you know, smell the air and eat the food and talk to each other. And Candace was one of I really liked everyone there, but I remember talking to you like that night that we were driving in a golf cart and, you know, like under a full moon. I was like, I've got to get her on the podcast.
it was a great time. And I took it as a time to meet other people and that, you know, and enjoy the air. I really wasn't there to work. I don't get vacations. I don't even know how to spell that word. And it's just like, so that was like, this is an incredible vacation that I got to be on with incredible minds. And there wasn't one person that wasn't revelatory to me. Everyone, every encounter was special, and everyone I will carry with me. They may not make it into my work, but they are a part of a moment of mine that was really quite special.
I'm like really grateful that that time happened, because the second I came back, life turned into, you know, probably just the average level of chaos, but having a moment that wasn't like that was really great. But wait, we've totally gone on a tangent. We've got to get back to your life, Candace. Kind of when did the transition from your kind of theater life to your art life, you know, to the visual art part of your life happen?
So I moved to New York. My life as an actress did not happen in New York, but an incredible capturing of spirits and souls and friends did. So I was able to capture a lot of memories. And again, it was the same kind of thing of how the theater happened to me. My life in New York happened the same way. I was in an apartment on the Upper West Side that my foyer was the size of some of my friends' studio apartments. I had 11 closets.
Whoa.
I had a bathroom that people said, can I come over and just take a bath, please? I could see Central Park from, off of the foyer was a door that led into the kitchen that was kind of small, but then there was a breakfast nook at the end of the kitchen that a window that I could see part of Central Park. Another long hallway, a very large living room, dining area, that faced Amsterdam Avenue, very large bedroom with a walk-in closet in the bedroom, another hallway that had 5 closets, and then this humongous bathroom. And so, and there was garbage pickup at your door every day. And there was mail delivery to your door.
Where is this magic place, by the way?
It was at 79th in Amsterdam on the Upper West Side.
How did you get this place?
The angels that attend me all the time.
I mean, I have angels too, but you know, my angels put me in like
angels.
Yeah, my angels had me in like a semi-squat situation in Midtown Manhattan, which I was incredibly grateful for. But you know, your angels did a bunch of job.
The day I saw the apartment, because I had not seen it, I flew into New Jersey. The person whose apartment it really was drove to the Newark airport, picked me up. My flight was very late. He waited for me, picked me up. He drove me to the apartment. He showed me where everything was. He introduced me to the doorman downstairs, said Candace will be subletting from me, so treat her very well. And he said, I'm going to go out with friends. I'll pick you up at 8 for dinner. I said, okay. I called my mother and I said, Mommy, I'm in a South Shore now. You have to understand South Shore. Parts of South Shore have apartment buildings that have 8, 10, 12 rooms. Places that you could roller skate down the hallways, just immense. I said, Mommy, I have a South Shore apartment. And she said, what? Because we didn't know. You know, we just didn't know what it was going to be. Because someone offered me their lease and I took it because it was New York. It was in Manhattan. I was not in the hinterlands. I was in Manhattan. I was not on the Lower East Side. I was on the Upper West Side. I knew that part was going to be all right. And then I saw this apartment. I was just like, oh my goodness, this is perfect.
What years were this?
Okay, so you're going to just like make me age myself, aren't you?
No, this could be any time.
So I think that I moved to New York in 84. I think it was 84.
Okay.
The owner of the apartment was a playwright and thinker by the name of Paul Carter Harrison. We lost him earlier this year. His memorial service was in Harlem a couple of months ago. And he changed how theater historians look at the African presence in theater. And so his first book is called The Drama of Nomo, N-O-M-M-O. And he has probably 8 other books on the African presence in theater. And it was on reading lists across the country and universities across the country for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And he was chair of the theater department at Columbia College in Chicago for years. And just a brilliant, brilliant man. And the work at Columbia was getting to be so much that he was rarely in New York. He had met me in Chicago. And I said, I want to go to New York. I want to be in New York. Yes, silliness. And so he offered me the apartment. And it was really that simple. And I paid $500 a month.
So I think this is what the reason for Marshall's, like, you know, what year was that? If both me and Marshall have lived in New York for a pretty long time, kind of in the starting mm-hmm. in the early 2000s, where you could still find like a little kind of crack in the universe where rent was inexpensive. Yeah. It was in a reasonably good part of the city, but that place would be the size of a closet and, you know, rent was probably not $500.
Yeah, I paid more than that in Chicago at that time. It was just like, one year that building gave me a rebate because the heating didn't cost as much because it had been a very mild winter. So they gave me some money back.
Yeah, I think we just, I think we missed all the good. You
know? So for 5 years, I never paid more than $534.
Wow. And so then is that where you started transitioning into a visual artist?
No, my life as a theater person just didn't work out. I became friends with a lot of writers, and a lot of people did their readings of new work in my place because I had a big place, no one else did. So rehearsals for things happened there, readings happened there. There's this wonderful energy. I could make some pasta last for, you know, from one person to 30 people. I was like, oh, I can put on some more pasta. Okay. So I always had champagne and pasta in my house, and people loved coming to visit. And so I did that until Paul wanted to come back. He had fallen in love with a woman who lived in New York, and she was in the financial industry, and she had to be in New York. So he says, I gotta come back. You have to go. And I was just like, oh shit. Are you sure? And I wanted to hate the woman. I really did. And the first time I met her, I said, okay. Yeah. She's kind of special. So you I get it.
Montage it for your
I get why you want to be here. And to this day, she's my best friend.
Oh, really?
So,
oh,
wow. Yeah. Yeah. So Wanda is very dear to me, and I'm very thankful that he fell in love with this woman, because he gave me an apartment for 5 years, and then he's given me a best friend for the rest of my life. So so it's still a pretty good deal. So I came back. Well, I didn't come straight back to Chicago. I went to Miami. And a friend of mine, Alice Day, who was a vocalist, a jazz vocalist, she was running the South Florida Jazz Festival at the time. And so she said, I need you to pitch in. You gotta stay at my house, you gotta pitch in. So, you know, I was doing, you know, work for the festival, and met some of the older musicians, several of them who were going on to Singapore, and were concerned about how things were really being handled. And so I was just like, so this is before email. And I said, well, can I see the letters that you got? And so I started deciphering things for them. And I says, do you mind if I call for you? Do you mind if I send this letter for you? And so next thing I knew, I was kind of managing several jazz musicians. And so I went from Miami to Singapore.
You know,
and lived well, you know, got a little paycheck and stayed in a suite. And then I came back to the States, and then I moved to LA, and I wasn't moving to LA. It was a vacation. And a friend of mine who was a producer on one of the biggest hit shows in America at the time, he said to me, Candace, you know, if you decided to write, you could make more money than you've ever dreamed of making. And I said, yeah, so how does that happen? And he says, well, you have a good mind. He says, so you need the credentials, so I need you to go back to school. He says, UCLA's writing program, School of Film, is really, you know, top notch. You walk out, you can demand anything you want. And I said, you're funny. First of all, I'm living in a studio apartment with a pallet on the floor and two good champagne glasses. That's all I have. That's it. I have nothing else. And he said, so apply. If you get in, I'll pay for it. So again, how does this happen? Someone says that they'll pay for UCLA graduate school for you. And I'm just like, so I'm going to apply. The application with your writing samples was 80 pages. 80, almost 100 pages.
That's more pages you'd have written in my life.
It was insane. And I applied. And women, when he told me this, it was literally 2 weeks before the application deadline. I got in. And I called him up and I said, so I need you to bring by champagne and a check. Because I have to pay the person. So here we go. So I started the program, and I was one of the survey courses. I was the, well, in this incoming class, I was the only woman. I was the only person of any kind of color, and I was the only person over 30. I was all by myself. And for the first time in my life, I was questioning my intelligence. These, and forgive me, Marshall, but these young white boys were making me feel very stupid. So whatever I said, they were like, you know, would not entertain whatever I said. Just, I was shut out of conversation. I was shut out of dialogue. And when they were in dialogue, Nietzsche was in the room. I'd go, who the fudge invited Nietzsche here again? Why is Nietzsche in this conversation? We're talking about Patton. Why is Nietzsche here? Nietzsche was there all the time. I was just like, what is going on? Am I missing something? Literally, I was feeling stupid because clearly everybody else was on the same page. And I was not. And I was just so distraught about it. And one of my professors who had done his graduate work at Northwestern here in Evanston, suburb of Chicago, I think he saw me one day and he said, can we meet? Can we chat? Can we talk? And I said, yes. And he says, so can I tell you that there's only one person in this group that I ever want to have coffee or tea or drink with? That would be you. These other people don't have a clue. They are so self-involved and are so moneyed that they've never been questioned a day in their lives. So I don't want you to give up. And so he invited me to a group of writers where they met every other Friday, but it was out in the valley. But these were the movers and shakers in Hollywood, but I didn't have a car. So during the day, I could catch like four buses to get somewhere, but then buses would stop at 10 p.m. So there's no way if they're doing a Friday evening kind of thing, you know, and I was of the sort that I wouldn't tell strangers in L.A. that I didn't have a car because something's wrong with you if you live in L.A. and you don't have a car. And so my nephew was about to be born, and I said, I think it's time for me to quit the L.A. moment. And so I left the program and came back to Chicago for the birth of my nephew, which is one of the best decisions I've ever made because he is my heart. And he's a brilliant young lawyer here in Chicago now. And I think I have a little to do with his brilliance, but he's my sweetheart. So I'm glad I came back to Chicago. So I came back to Chicago and I'm just like, oh God, I've got to make some money. So first I took a waitressing job, which, you know, lowest, you know, hanging fruit. I waitressed. 2 weeks later, the owner of this new restaurant said, I'd like you to manage the restaurant. I'm just like, dang, I don't want to do that. So I did that for another 6 months. Then a friend called me and said, Candace, do you want a job? And I'm just like, no, not really. And they're like, so I work for this organization. It's like no politics. And, you know, you can do literary arts here and, you know, you'll get a check every 2 weeks and insurance. And I was just like, oh, that's kind of cool. A check and insurance. Okay. So I applied. They hired me almost immediately, except I was not hired to teach literary arts. I was hired to teach math. Now, this is the thing. I hate math. I was one of those kids that just, it did not sink in. I couldn't grab hold of it. That level of the brain, that size side of the brain did not do that work. And I was just like, dang. So I had to figure out a way that these young people that I was working with and I could both succeed. So this was a program that was for children who had found traditional high school a challenge. And it was an alternative school and program. And so I went in the first day and I asked them, okay, at your old school, who hated math? So all the hands went up, including mine. I said, so who really disliked their math teacher? Oh, you know, hands just went up. And I said, so that would be me too. And I said, who failed math? And so the hands shot up. And I said, I didn't fail, but I did not get grades I'd been getting everywhere else. And I said, so I think that people who teach math, it's what their brains do. And so they don't understand how someone else doesn't get what they get. And so they can't teach you because they don't understand that you're not getting it. It's not that you're being lazy. You just don't get it. And I said, now this is the great thing. We don't have to invent any new hypotheses. We don't have to sit and think of universes with numbers. These things have already been thought out and put on paper. So now it's a memory game. So let's play memory games so that we can learn this. I said, it's like theater. It's like learning a script. We're going to learn memory games. And so I found every kind of trick there was to get through basic algebra. So I got through it. They got through it. And it was kind of amazing to me that I was able to rework how I thought about it. And so I could get these kids to succeed. And so that was kind of cool. And did that for 18 months. And then I got a call from someone else with an arts program in Chicago who said, do you want a job? And I'm just like, well, every time someone said that to me, it's kind of like, wait, what kind of trick is this? What are you doing? So it was with an incredible arts agency in Chicago by the name of Gallery 37. And so I interviewed, I got the position, and I was the career development officer. I was an officer. And I worked with young people, high school students in the arts, get into art school. And I'm going to say that every kid who came to me who said they wanted to go to school, I got them in.
Wow.
Every kid who came to me who said my parents don't have the money, I said, we're going to get the money. And they got the money.
That's awesome.
And so, but I did that for 18 months. So I've had two real jobs in my life. And they were both for 18 months because I'm clearly not cut out to work for other people. It's not who I am.
You just said your life. And it's like there have been 20 lifetimes all wrapped up and we still haven't got to your
visual. Okay. All right. So the Gallery 37 job. There's an incredible gallery on the fourth floor of this building. And most of the time it was for our young student artists for different kinds of shows. But once a year they would do a show for the teaching artist. And so I'm looking at the hustle and bustle of getting this. And I ask, well, what about those folks who are in administration here who are artists? And literally, looking down noses at me about administrative people aren't artists. These are artists, our teaching artists. I said, but I'm an artist. And they were like, So they gave us a little side room. Anybody who was in administration had this little side room for a gallery to present whatever they want to do. And I said, this is ridiculous. And so I'm going to show them. So a friend of mine had just opened a new space for her business, IC Stars, and had this gorgeous space. And I called her up and I said, I want to have a one-woman show in your space. And she said, sure, what, when, how? And I said, it's going to be called Ethiomai, and it's going to be my take on Ethiopian sacred art. And they were reverse glass paintings that I had. And I think I made like 22 of them. And in the somewhere in getting ready for that show, I had one of those anxiety moments, like, oh, I don't know what I'm doing. Why am I doing this? This is stupid. And I got up, and from up underneath my bed, I pulled out some handmade paper that I had made like 2 summers prior at one of those art kind of things I went away to learn how to make large format paper, you know, and it was the doing, not what you do with the paper afterwards. So, you know, I made this paper, it was under my bed. I pulled it out. My niece had given me this beautiful glass stylus for a birthday present. I said, well, that's too beautiful to ever use. Oh my God. So I pulled out the stylus. I pulled out pigment. I literally ground it. So here goes the work. So I'm grinding the pigment. I took the stylus, I took this paper, and I started doing little circles. And I just kept doing little circles. And while I was doing little circles, I was saying the Lord's Prayer. And it was all a measure to calm myself. And I worked probably from about 6 a.m. until midnight, except for water and potty breaks. I was just doing this just to ground myself. When it was done and I was feeling better, I put it under the bed with the other paper that I had, right? It was not art to me. It was just something that I needed to, so I could calm down. The next day I was taking the rest of the work to the framers for the show for Ethiomai. And this is when you guys are gonna think I'm crazy. So bear with me. Literally a voice said, take that big piece with you to the framers. I said to the voice, are you crazy? Do you know how big that is? Do you know how expensive that is going to be to frame? I'm not taking that. The voice said, take it. I took it. I had it framed. The framer showed up to, the driver showed up to deliver the work to the space a few days before the opening. And I owed like, you know, half my bill for all this framing for the show, of which he was supposed to collect. And he said, my the owner needs to speak with you. Can you call her? So I stopped, I called her, and she says, so we have a little problem. I said, what's the problem? She said, so your piece on glass, it broke. And I'm just like, okay, you broke one of my pieces. And she goes, so we've done something that we want you to take a look at because we think you might like it. So, you know, Julio is going to show it to you. So he showed me the piece. And I said, I really appreciate your trying to make this okay. But it looks broken to me. It was not my intention. This is now something with your intention added to it. So it's no longer my art. And so she was just like, well, how much is this for sale for? So I didn't want her to think that I was just calling numbers out of my head. So I said, I'm going to fax you the sales sheet for the entire show. So I sent her the sales sheet. She asked, could she speak to the driver? He turned around, he left, did not speak to me. They never asked me for the other half of the payment for all of that framing. Hmm. So the voice that said, get it framed, said, I told you.
And so this piece that had nothing to do with Ethiopian sacred art went up on the wall. It was the piece that everyone responded to. And so people kept saying things about it, asking me about it, and I was being flippant. And this one woman says, well, you know, what is it? I said, oh, it's a prayer circle. And I was just, because I'd been praying and I'd been making circles while I prayed. But the moment I said it, the history of African-Americans in this country, the history and knowledge that there were grandmothers and grandfathers in fields and in backs of churches and in basements, praying their way out of an untenable situation and praying for future generations that would not have to live like they lived. I said, I can't play with that word, those two words again. Prayer circles are real. And though I didn't know those women who prayed, there were women who prayed for my eventuality. I said, so I can't play with that anymore. And so people continued that night to ask me about the piece. And so, because I am flippant still, they said, so what are you going to do with this? I says, well, they are called prayer circles, and I'm going to create enough so that I have 3 shows a year for 3 years, and they're all going to be in sacred spaces. I don't know where any of that came from. I said it, and then guess what? I had to do it because I said it. While I'm saying this to one woman, another woman came up behind me and said, hi, I'd like to introduce myself. I'm blah, 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 Reverend so-and-so. I'm the arts ministry at the Church of Three Crosses in Chicago. I would love to talk to you about the eventuality of your first show being at our church. That was the first show at Church of the Three Crosses.
Wow.
Something so incredible happened right before that show opened. There was a new female minister at that church, and she had 2 little boys. And one of the pieces I brought in, the circles were done on leather, and the hide looked like a map. And I actually started that when the U.S., I'm going to say the U.S., declared war on Iran. And I started praying that night for every son and daughter who would be lost in the war, for every mother of every son and daughter who would weep for their child. And so I did these circles and I prayed for these people and for the eventuality of peace. So when I took that piece into the church, the minister was there and her son was standing there and he was looking at it and he's tugging on his mother and she says, ask the artist. So I'm trying to take the work in there to hang on the walls. I don't want to talk to little children. I really didn't. So he says, what does this mean, this piece here? And so I'm never going to answer for a child. And I says, I don't know. What does it mean to you? What does it look like to you? And he says, I think it looks like a map. And I says, wow, that's funny because I thought it looked like a map too. I said, what else do you see? He said, I see the souls of people who are going to die in the war.
Whoa.
Well, okay. I'm going to keep talking to this child because that child saw the entire intention of the piece. He felt the intention of the piece. Hmm. And at that moment, I said, I'm on the right track. This is what I need to continue to do. Yes, I said it kind of as a joke. The same voice that said, put this piece in the show, directed that minister to say, I want it at my church, directed this little boy to look at it and spend time with a piece of art, a little child who spent time with this piece. And so that was the first showing. And that evening at that opening, a woman came up to me and she said, "Hi, I'm on the board of directors at the Garrett Theological Seminary at Northwestern University. We would love this show. Can I set up a meeting with our board and you?" Yes, you can. And so each show happened from an opening night. Each subsequent show happened from an opening night. So I was able to do 3 years, three shows per year, all in sacred spaces. And so that was the real beginning of my life as a visual artist, was the show called Prayer Circles, Sacred Text and Abstract Thought. So that's the start of my life as a visual artist.
It's an incredible story. What do you attribute to this? It feels like you, is it integrity? Is it your intelligence? Is it your charisma? Is it a higher power?
Can I answer for Candace?
Yes, please. Let me hear this.
You're like the single most instantly likable person that I've possibly ever met. Like, I feel like I knew you for like 10 minutes and I was like, oh yeah, like she's, you know, that you seem, so you are very charismatic and very intelligent, but there's something else where like people want to trust you and like you because that seems like the core of you.
So maybe 6 months ago, I have this wonderful young woman who works with me a couple of afternoons a week, Senya. And one day she said, I was talking to someone, we hung up the phone, and she said, "Okay, another one." I said, "Another one what?" And she says, "You Candace-ize them." I said, "What?" She says, "That's what you do. You Candace-ize people." The woman was ready to chew nails and you talked to her for like 3 minutes and she was just like, "Oh, can I be your best friend now?" And I'm just like, what? What are you talking about?
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree with this young woman. But I'm glad it's a good term. I'm going to start using it.
Fantasizing people, she says, it's what I do. And what's so crazy, Cuddy Hunk was the first residency I've ever received, and I've applied to many. And there's something about, and my written word is good, but there's something about, I don't translate well on paper. When I'm able to talk to people about a project I want to do or something, they're on board. When I'm just, they don't know me and it's written, it's going to them, I get the letter says, "Thank you so very much for your application." So my rejection file is huge. But when I get to talk to people, they buy in. And I'm not trying to sell anyone. I'm just being me. And whatever that is.
I mean, you have the other stuff. So you have the creativity and the hard work. But honestly, a lot of people are creative and work hard and aren't nearly half as likable as you. like there's a magic to you. And I'm not like, I'm actually not being flippant about it.
Thank you. Like I'm going to accept that. I'm going to accept that from you. Thank you. Thank you.
And I'm really,
and you know why, Dina? It takes magic to see magic. That laugh right there. Yeah. Marshall knows it, don't you, Marshall?
I don't have it, but I know it.
she's a little tiny thing of magic. She really is.
That's true. Yes.
I'm not sure I've got the things that you have, but I also recognize it. Like the And so all of these kind of things, like the way you describe your life, it just kind of went from one thing to another, but really kind of the overweight, you know, like above all that is this combination of like hard work and the canticizing.
But it is hard work. It's,
But neither could exist, you know, like if you were just a very charming person, you know, without
work,
then, you know, you would have had a very different life.
But you know, the people who just talk.
It also seems like you focus your whole life on people too. Like relationships are very important to you. So maybe there's an authenticity to your connections with people that's a little undeniable.
Yeah, I agree. I like people. I really do. And I think there's something absolutely wonderful and everyone's experiences. And so it's wonderful to find out what that is. Sometimes you don't want to stay with all the experiences, you know? But there's something really wonderful about everyone's story, because everybody's got one. Even people who, you know, you may not like or something, you know, upon first meeting. And then you get, if you're careful and you take that moment to listen to them, to hear them, there's something really wonderful at the kernel, I think, of each and every one of us. Mm. And so I like people.
And your work is about people's stories, right? Like a lot about the African-American experience and those sorts of things. What is that? What is that about your, what draws you to those themes in your work? I just want to ask you a little bit about that.
A family of service, that a grandfather who was the epitome of what service means and looks like, and the work that entails to be of service to community, to be raised by my mother, who was of service to the children that she taught and the community that she worked in, to the nuns who taught me. Being a Catholic kid, you're taught service is the ultimate ticket to salvation. You know, you have to be of service to the world. You're not on this planet by yourself. You cannot survive by yourself. You cannot create by yourself. All of that is selfish, and we're taught to be selfless. So it was all of my upbringing that made me who I am. And I'm very thankful for all of those folks. My dad, who didn't understand that I couldn't do math, but, you know, I went them all.
You know, probably some of the worst fights me and my engineer father, who's overall amazing, have ever had was when he would try to, you know, I started failing math very early on, like those kids that you were teaching. And then they put me in one of these alternative programs, like at my high school for like alternative math. And I managed to fail that too, which, you know,
because I didn't get my hands on you. We would have worked it out.
But at some point, I remember my father saying, you know, for the good of our relationship, I will accept the fact that you can't do this, and I will never try to teach you how to do this again. And he was right. After that, you know, I kept being bad at math, but at least me and him started, you know, we became friends.
Oh, good.
Yeah, but you know how what you were saying, kind of that your mother wanted you to have, you know, basically like have the world and see the world. And it feels like you kind of became, in a way, what, you know, like whether it's because of her or because of you, like you have the world. Like you did so much and you've seen so much and you've had so many lives. And also this podcast could totally go on for like 10 hours, except we don't have it because at some point my parents will want me to get my kids back. But what I wanted to ask is, where is your life right now? Like the...
So there are things I probably shouldn't say. I'm at one of those places career wise where other people are, you know, in charge of certain things. And I'm gonna go ahead and say it. My gallery is not being pro Candace. And so I'm really trying to figure out next steps, next levels, because I think it's time that I hit that next level, whatever it is. I don't know what it is, but I think it's time that I do that. So the indication to me after Cutty Hunk that I was in that Museum of Art show, it opened, you know, my eye just a little bit more to say that there are more possibilities for me. Because in the past, I've always let the wind predict my next move, my next step, or, you know, the goodness, the kindness of other people who heard me talk and say, oh, let me take you here, or let me give you this, you know, and it's not been me in charge of my life. And so I'm starting to recognize that, you know, there are more days behind me than in front of me. And where do I want to end up with my career? And how do I want that career to be seen and remembered? Because I do want it to be remembered. And I want to be celebrated. And I want to be celebrated before I'm wheeled across the stage in my wheelchair and my head bouncing a little and going, thank you so much. And, you know, it's just, my Audrey, my Katharine Hepburn. You know, I don't want to be that person. I want to be able to walk across the stage and say, thank you. Well, I want to go. I'm so thrilled that the museum has seen fit to put the work here. That's what I want. That's where I think I'm trying to take myself. Because in the past, and Marshall heard it, it was the winds that have carried me. They've been very favorable winds. But it's been the winds that have carried me to every good thing. And now I think it's time for me to take hold of the reins of my career and my life and how I want it to be seen.
So. What's that poem that everyone has to memorize in sixth grade? Invictus.
Oh, God.
Oh, I'm sorry. I am the master of my fate. I'm the captain of my soul.
Yes.
You knew what I meant.
Yes. I might have to pull it up and put it on the wall. What did I say?
Well, if anybody's going to reach that next level, I believe in you. And it's inspiring to me that you've already achieved so much and you're still saying, there's things I want to achieve. I mean, you've been in museums with your heroes, you've had all these fantastic shows and done all this impactful art. And it's like, it's very encouraging. The whole talk has been amazing.
Well, can I say one thing that maybe if I don't get to where I really see myself being, I was so encouraged yesterday because my daughter, who never shares her college life with her parents at all, like, if I don't ask specific questions, if, you know, like, so honey, will we be graduating this year? You know, I don't get, you know, an insight into her life. Yesterday, she texted her dad and I with a series of liner cuts that she had done that took my breath away. I was just like, oh God, these are beautiful. These are just like stunning. And I was just like, okay, so maybe I don't hit where I want to hit. Maybe she'll do that for both her dad and I, because her dad's an artist as well.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, because she's always said she didn't want to do this art thing with us anymore. She's been saying that since sixth grade. She's like, I don't want to go to any more galleries. I don't want to go to any more museums. I don't want to do any openings. No.
She's like, I'm going to do that.
She's like, okay, wait, what you going to do?
Was she like, I just want to be a chartered accountant.
She wanted to be a vet.
Oh, that's sweet.
She wanted to be a vet until I told her it was not about petting animals. It was about math. She said, I'll think of something else. You know, but she's an artist now. And I, you know, wow. I'm just thrilled because she's quite brilliant. Her work is masterful. It was technically proficient and it was beautiful.
Wow.
I was just like, ooh, will you give your mom one? Could I just have one? Just one?
So what was you mentioned that during COVID, all three of you were making art in the same space. What was that like?
That was horrible. That was torture. That was cruel and unusual punishment for each and every one of us. I had Arthur create a little space that was just mine. We walled off a portion of one room. So it was only like 4 feet deep and 3.5 feet wide. And that was my little space. And, you know, it became a gallery wall. I had a table to work on. And I created one of my most successful shows from that little space. And Aisha I did videos every week and she videotaped them and she edited them. And we did classes for anybody who wanted to join in. I think the first week of Shelter in Place in Chicago, I started doing classes on Instagram. Started out with like 14, 15 people. And by the time I finished, I had like 400 people who came in every week. Wow. To see what they were going to not necessarily learn, but just laugh with me, because I would tell stories and I'd laugh a lot and they'd laugh with me. And, you know, and I'd be talking about mark making. And next thing I was talking about, I don't know, something that, you know, jumped in my head, and I'd be off on a tangent. I'd be like, oh yeah, so back to mark making. So hold your pencil like this, or, you know. And I got an incredible Instagram following, Dina, from doing those classes. My Instagram princess there. I got collectors all over the country from offering free classes every week.
Wow.
So
what's,
it was before
what's your Instagram account? So people listening can follow you. What's your Instagram account?
Klee Art, CLEEART. So my signature is Klee, and so it's Klee Art, and that's IG.
But by the way, I'm sure your classes are amazing, but you should, you know, you should consider your own podcast, because I feel like I would like there's not that many people I would tune in to listen to every week, but I would listen to you. And I think so would a lot of other people.
I have thought about it, but then it's like a lot of thoughts I have. They go, they hit the ground. Because it's just like, oh God, that's some work. Oh, more work. Oh.
Who needs more work?
Who needs more work? But before we go, because I know you're trying to signal off, Dina, I could tell. I'm going to turn the screen around. I think, am I going the right way? Oh yeah, I did. So I'm having, my studio is at the Hyde Park Art Center in Chicago. And I have been contracted to do a large show in the Cantor Gallery on the second floor here, November of 23. And I had my first curatorial meeting last week, and I did the prototype for some of the work. And Dina, can you see this?
It looks beautiful. Can you show closer? Maybe I can like spotlight you.
Let me unplug computer. So, no, I don't think I can, baby. Well, wait a minute.
Yeah, but I can make you bigger.
So those are some of the rocks and algae from Cuddy, huh?
You brought it back.
I brought it back. And what I loved when I saw those rocks for the first time was that, are you still there? Oh, you look like you were frozen. So I'm working with two books that are both Octavia Butler books, the Xenogenesis trilogy and her Parable of the Sower, and the convergence of those two books, and looking at what does other mean, what does other look like, eugenics, and how it's raised its ugly non-scientific head many, many times over the course of humanity, and what that looks like, and how these two books converge. And so when I saw those rocks with the algae, I kept thinking of the lead character, main character from Xenogenesis, who mates with these aliens that have saved the human population. And it's a history lesson in eugenics. And how long does it take to breed out the other? And can you ever breed out the other? And the answer is no, you cannot, because our genes stay sitting in there somewhere, and it'll be, you know, 10 generations later, and this baby will come out black and like, wait, what? How did this happen? Who played in the sandbox? And so eugenics is a false science. It really had nothing to do with genetics. And so looking how Octavia Butler played with the thought of that in terms of aliens in human beings and trying to create a new race, and they never really do. So this lead character is so powerful that who she is remains. But I was thinking about the birth of her first child, whose name is David. So what that birth would have looked like. And I saw the rocks and the algae that looked like cellulose to me. And so I started thinking about that as the embryonic sac that we'll see as part of it. And so I tore up
I see it. You know, it's actually kind of too bad this podcast is not audio only.
Yeah, I know. So so I'm working with what because I use a lot of resourced materials and recycled materials in all of my work that I do. And so I'm gathering very specific old VHS tapes that have some other kind of importance that will be part of the embryonic sac. And this thing is going to be huge, that part of it. So this was just a sneak peek when I sat with the two curators who are working with me. So all of that was on the ground, this huge pile of cellulose is from one film. And the film was What's Love Got to Do with It? So there'd be like little jokes inside of it that, you know, no one else is going to know but me. And that's okay. Because I like jokes that sit inside of things hidden away. So I'm looking right now, I'm going to resale shops and I'm looking for cassette tapes, which you really can't find much anymore. You used to be able to. So I'm digging deep, trying to find them and asking friends, can I have, you know, some old tapes that, you know, you're never going to play again because you don't even have a tape recorder now, a tape player, you know, this ancient stuff, which when it's piled up, it looks like something else. So it's creating these new worlds and something that was real, something that is now obsolete, that can also give birth to something new.
And I've always thought that film almost looks like, if it's twisted, almost looks like DNA anyway.
It does. It really does. So I'm going to be playing with a lot of that and the brown and the black nature of it in part of the large part of the installation. So I'm really looking forward to the build out of the show. And I'm probably going to have to get a bigger studio space than what I have to make it happen. But very excited about that. And that's part of my real work in terms of trying to direct my own career as opposed to the winds coming by me. So moving towards that show.
You know, on the other hand, if the winds remain favorable and you know which direction you want to go in, I feel like you're golden. Candace, thank you so much. If you're ever in Boston or New York or, you know, anywhere, I'll do my best to cook for you. I'm probably not going to be as good as those cutty hunk people that were cooking for us.
Who is as good as that woman? I mean, she was just great. But thank you. So, you know, my niece is in Boston, so I do try to get there at least once a year. And I told that lovely, brain fart.
Meredith.
No. Rachel. Rachel. God, Rachel, when you hear this, please forgive me. We met for lunch at the MFA, my one afternoon that I had in Boston right after the museum. So yeah, I had one more day, you know, coming back from Mystic into Boston before I flew out that evening. So I hit like 4 states in 48 hours. How did that happen? I was just like, I'm everywhere in 2 days. So she met me, we went for lunch, and we saw the Obama portraits on tour. And it's so funny because I'd seen them at the National Gallery and here in Chicago. So I got to see them a third time. And I don't even care to see them anymore. What I love is to listen to eavesdrop on people talking about. Because people give themselves away when they start talking about these two people.
What kind of thing did you hear?
Oh, so a lot of people have never paid any attention to who Amy Sherald is and how she paints, and that she paints Black folk in a gray tone always. And then there's color in the dress, the sky, the foreground, the background. But the faces, the arms, the fingertips are all grayscale. And they're just like, well, she doesn't really look like that. No, she does. Well, and all the conversation is usually about Michelle. It's not about Barack's portrait. It's all about Michelle. It's either she's prettier than that, or she's not that pretty, or she, you know, it's just hilarious to listen to people have those conversations about this portrait.
All right, next time you're here, or if I make it to Chicago, let's go and work and listen to people talk about paintings. And
yay.
And I want more of your stories, because you've had this incredibly rich, complicated, kind of wonderful life.
Kind of wonderful life, yes.
Candace, so, this is an absolute pleasure. Nice to meet you. What a nice meeting you.
All right, guys.
Marshall, I told you she's great. I told you she'd be great. Yes. Candace, good luck to you. And thank you so much.
Thank you, sweetheart. I'll see you before the next year's out.
Yes.
That's a promise. All right. Okay. Bye, Marshall.
Bye, Candace.
Okay.
Thank you for listening, and I hope you got some good painting done while we entertain you with our amazing guest. If you like what you're hearing, follow and subscribe to our podcast if you haven't done so yet. And if you're so inclined, rate us whether you love or hate us. We love hearing all the different opinions and appreciate the feedback. You can reach out to us at artgrindpodcast@gmail.com. Or DM us on IG at ArtGrind Podcast. You faithful listeners have the power to help us grow. so please spread the word. It's free, and you'll feel good about it. So until next time, stay on the grind while we fill your mind.